I was lying in bed last night doing that thing we all promised ourselves we wouldn't do.
Let me guess. Doom scrolling.
Doom scrolling, exactly. It was about 11:30 p.m. The blue light was just burning my retinas and I was just swiping. And the sequence of things I was seeing, it felt like a fever dream.
Usually does. What was on the menu last night?
Well, first it was some drone strike footage from that escalating conflict in Eastern Europe. Then, swipe a report on the Category 6 hurricane.
Which didn't even used to be a category, by the way.
Right, exactly. A category that literally shouldn't exist, just barreling toward the coast. Swipe again. The stock market is jittering because of supply chain failures. Swipe again. A massive protest in a city that used to be peaceful, and there are cars on fire.
Yeah, that is the classic everything everywhere all at once effect.
That is exactly what it felt like. It felt like I was being pelted by this meteor shower of completely unrelated disasters. And the overwhelming feeling wasn't just fear. I mean, it was fear, obviously, but it was also confusion. Just this profound sense of randomness. Like, why is everything breaking at the exact same time?
That feeling of fragmentation is incredibly common, and it's actually a symptom of how we consume information.
Right.
We're trained by the media, by our education system, to put all these things into separate boxes.
Right. So the war is a military problem.
Yes.
The hurricane is an environmental problem. The market crash is an economic problem. And the protest is a social problem.
Exactly. And so we have military experts for the war, we have meteorologists for the hurricane, economists for the crash, and everyone is just looking at their specific silo. But today, we're going to do something a little different. We're looking at a force that claims these aren't separate fires at all.
Yeah.
They're actually coming from the same arsonist. Or, to be more precise, they're the result of the exact same faulty wiring in the house we all live in.
I love that analogy. So we are zooming out. We were doing a deep dive today into a white paper that honestly really shook me a little bit. It's titled The Grammar of Violence: Structural Drivers of Systemic Harm and Pathways to Viability.
It is a fascinating and I will say somewhat heavy document.
It really is. And it was published just today, actually, February 24th, 2026. And the authorship is something we really need to talk about right off the bat because it's written by Dr. Bechara Sesili.
Who's a medical doctor?
Right, a medical doctor with a deep background in biology and internal medicine. And he co-authored it with ChatGPT 5.2.
Which I know might sound like a gimmick to some listeners, but in the context of this specific paper, it's actually central to their methodology.
How so?
Well, you have a biological systems thinker, someone who intimately understands how an organism lives, how it regulates itself, or how it dies, collaborating with a massive global pattern recognition engine.
Okay, that makes sense.
And because of that unique combination, they aren't looking at politics or economics the way a pundit on cable news looks at them. They are looking at the state of the world like a diagnosis.
Like a medical diagnosis.
Precisely. They are looking for the underlying pathology. The central question they are asking is, why do these crises, the war, the poverty, the ecological collapse, why do they just keep happening? And why do they seem to follow the exact same recursive patterns decade after decade?
And they argue that we are suffering from what they call structural blindness.
Right. We are obsessed with the events.
The symptoms.
Yes, the symptoms. The specific riot, the specific bomb, the specific bank failure. But we are blind to the grammar, the hidden rules that actually structure those events.
The grammar of violence. It is such a striking phrase.
It really is. Think about language for a second. When you speak, you aren't consciously thinking about the rules of grammar.
No, not at all.
You don't think, okay, subject, then verb, then object, you just speak. The grammar is completely invisible to you, but it dictates exactly what you can and cannot say. It literally structures your reality.
So this paper is arguing that our global civilization has a hidden grammar, a set of invisible rules that makes violence, extraction, and destruction basically make
That
sense.
makes them rational within the system. That makes them profitable. And until we see that grammar, we are just fighting symptoms forever. We're mopping up water from an overflowing sink without ever turning off the faucet.
So our mission today, for you listening, is to find the faucet. We want to expose this invisible architecture. But before we go any further, I want to make a very clear disclaimer because I know exactly how this sounds. Hidden rules, invisible architecture.
It sounds like we are about to launch into a massive conspiracy theory.
Exactly. I can hear the comments typing themselves right now. Who is pulling the strings? Is it the Illuminati? Is it a secret cabal of billionaires in a smoke-filled room?
We need to be very clear about this. The source material explicitly rejects that framing. This is not a conspiracy theory.
Right.
There is no single villain twirling a mustache at the top of a volcano.
Which, in a weird way, is almost more terrifying.
It is much more terrifying.
Yeah.
If it were just a group of bad guys, we could just find them, expose them, and arrest them. Problem solved.
Yeah, that would be easy.
But the paper argues that the problem isn't people. It's protocols. It is a set of incentives and logic loops that good people, smart people, kind people wake up and follow every single day simply because that is just how the world works.
It's the water we swim in, like the fish who doesn't know what water is.
Exactly. The authors describe structural blindness as a natural result of our extreme specialization.
Give me an example of that.
Sure. So you have a brilliant economist who is a master at understanding interest rates, but he is not looking at the ecological cost of the endless growth those rates are designed to create. Or you have a general who is a genius at logistics and strategy, but he isn't looking at the generational trauma his military operations are causing in the civilian population. They are staring so hard at their individual pixels.
And they are completely missing the big picture.
They're missing the fact that the entire house is on fire.
Okay, let's unpack this. If we want to start seeing the grammar, we need a framework. And the paper starts with a concept from the sociologist Johann Galtung. He calls it the violence triangle. And I found this incredibly helpful for just visualizing what we are actually talking about today.
It's the foundational tool for this entire deep dive. So imagine a triangle. Or actually, let's use the iceberg analogy the paper references. I think it's a bit more intuitive for most people.
Okay, so I'm picturing an iceberg floating in the ocean.
Right, so the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
The part sticking out above the water that you can clearly see, the part that hits the ship, that is direct violence.
And this is what makes the evening news?
Yes. This is an event. It has a clear subject, a clear object, and a clear action. Someone hits someone. A police officer strikes a protester with a baton. A missile hits an apartment building. A husband hits a wife.
It is visible. It is visceral. And it's where, let's be honest, 99% of our moral outrage goes. We see the video on our feed, we get angry, and we demand justice.
And usually justice in that specific context just means punish the person who did the bad thing.
Right. If we just put the bad apple in jail, the problem is solved. The system is fixed.
But the paper argues that if you stop your analysis there, you are mistaking the eruption for the actual volcano. Because underneath the waterline, holding that visible tip up, is the massive hidden bulk of the iceberg. And the first layer down, the biggest layer, is structural violence.
Now, this is the one that is a bit harder to wrap your head around at first, because there's no specific bad guy holding a gun.
There is no gun at all, and often there is zero malicious intent. This is a crucial distinction. Structural violence is defined in the source as any social arrangement that reduces life potential below what is materially possible.
That is a very dense phrase. Reduces life potential. Let's ground that in a real-world example so we can really see it.
Okay, let's look at hunger. That is the classic example the authors use. Right now, globally, we actually produce enough food to feed every single human being on the planet comfortably. The material capacity exists.
The food is there.
The food is there. The logistics exist. We have the trucks. We have the refrigeration. We have the grain. That is an objective fact.
So technically, nobody needs to starve. It is not a scarcity problem.
Exactly. It is absolutely not a scarcity problem.
Yeah.
And yet millions of people are malnourished or actively starving right now. Now, why is that? Is it because the grocery store manager hates them?
No.
Is it because the truck driver is evil and wants them to suffer?
Obviously not. It's because they simply don't have the money to buy the food.
Right. The market mechanism, the overarching structure of pricing, distribution, and profit, does not view it as rational to move that food to people who cannot pay for it. So the food sits in warehouses or it rots or it is literally thrown away while people starve.
That gap, the gap between we could feed them and they are starving, that space right there is the structural violence.
Precisely. The violence is in the spreadsheet, not the fist. Nobody has to be bad for the result to be bad. The system is functioning exactly as it was designed to function to maximize efficiency and financial profit. But the output of that system is a massive reduction in human life potential.
It's silent. It's slow. It's preventable diseases running rampant. It's pollution-induced asthma in poor neighborhoods located next to factories. It's poverty right in the middle of unbelievable plenty.
And because it is so slow and so impersonal, we generally don't call it violence.
No, we don't.
We call it the economy. We call it bad luck. We call it just the way things are.
Which brings us to the third corner of the triangle. The bottom layer of the iceberg. The thing that actually convinces us to accept all this suffering as completely normal. cultural violence.
This is the legitimacy layer. Cultural violence implies the stories, the myths, the ideologies, the religion, the science, and the specific language that we use to justify the other two layers.
Galtung uses this traffic light metaphor in the paper, right?
Yes. Think about direct violence.
Mm-hmm.
Killing someone, starving someone.
Yeah.
Morally, universally, that should be a red light.
Yeah.
Stop. That is wrong. The function of cultural violence is to subtly turn that light from red to green, or at the very least, to yellow.
It changes the moral color of the act.
Exactly. It makes the intolerable seem entirely tolerable, necessary even.
The paper lists some really chilling examples of this color-changing language, and the one that always gets me every time I hear it on the news is collateral damage.
That is a prime example of cultural violence in action. Think about what that phrase actually does to your brain. If a pilot drops a bomb on a residential house on purpose to kill a family, we call that murder. That's a red light.
Absolutely.
But if the pilot drops a bomb on a military target and incidentally destroys a residential house right next door, killing that exact same family, we call it collateral damage.
Even though the biological result is identical, a dead family, a destroyed home.
But the language, the culture, has completely rewritten the meaning of the event. It shifts it from a war crime to an unfortunate necessity. It turns the light yellow.
Another one they mentioned that really hit home for me is market discipline.
Oh, that's a huge one in the corporate world. When a massive company lays off 5,000 workers just to boost its quarterly stock price, that is a profound act of violence against that community.
Yeah.
It destroys marriages, it increases local suicide rates, it bankrupts small local businesses. That is structural violence on a massive scale.
But we don't say the CEO committed violence against the town.
No, never. We say the market demanded discipline, or they had to trim the fat. We spook about the market as if it were a god, like this omnipotent force of nature that we just have to sacrifice human lives to. That is cultural violence. It frames human choices as natural inevitabilities.
So let's look at the loop here, because this is where it gets really dark. The culture validates the structure. The structure causes the harm. And then, and this is the part that just twists my brain in knots, when the direct violence inevitably happens, the system uses that violence to prove the culture was right all along.
That is the self-fulfilling prophecy of the whole machine. Imagine that structural violence, say, extreme poverty and lack of resources, causes a riot. That's direct violence.
Right.
The culture doesn't look at the riot and say, oh, we need to fix the poverty that caused this. The culture says, see, we told you those people were dangerous. We need more police. We need more weapons. We need more control.
It constantly validates the need for force. The triangle just feeds itself.
It is a closed loop, a self-sealing tank.
Okay, so that is the architecture. We've got the triangle. But machines run on software, right? The paper argues that we are all running a specific script in our heads that keeps this violent machine going. They call it conflict grammar.
Yes. This moves us from the realm of sociology into psychology. It's about how we fundamentally think about conflict itself.
And they contrast two completely different scripts. The one we use most of the time, the one that dominates our news feeds and our politics, is called DMA.
DMA. It stands for dualism, manichaeism, and Armageddon.
I mean, it sounds like a heavy metal album track list.
It really does. But once you understand these three terms, I guarantee you will see them in almost every single political speech given in the last 50 years.
Let's break them down for the listener, starting with dualism.
Dualism is essentially the refusal to see complexity. It divides the world strictly into two camps. Binary thinking. Us versus them. Male versus female. West versus East. Democracy versus autocracy.
It just deletes the middle ground completely.
It deletes the entire web of connection. It says we are completely separate from that.
Okay, then manichaeism.
This is an old religious concept, but in this context, it refers to the moralizing of that division. So it's not just that we are different from them, it's that we are good and they are evil. We represent the light and they represent the darkness.
And once you have established that the other side isn't just a competitor or someone with different interests, but literal, irredeemable evil,
then you inevitably move to the third stage, which is Armageddon.
The final battle.
Right. If the other side is evil, you cannot negotiate with them. You cannot compromise.
Because compromise with evil is contamination.
Exactly. Compromise with the cancer is just death. The only rational solution under this script is total victory. You must completely annihilate the other side.
Like you are either with us or against us.
Axis of evil. The final solution. Total war. This is the grammar of annihilation. And think about the real-world consequences of running this script in your head. If you truly believe this, then diplomacy looks like weakness. Nuance looks like treason. Just trying to understand why the other side is acting the way they are looks like you are sympathizing with the enemy.
It just shuts down the brain. It shuts down all higher-level thinking.
It's a cognitive short circuit.
Yeah.
And it is incredibly seductive because it offers perfect moral clarity. It feels really good to be the shining knight fighting the evil dragon. It rallies the population. It creates intense social cohesion.
But the paper brings up a psychological mechanism here called projection, which suggests that this cohesion is actually based on a massive lie.
This is a vital insight from the authors. They argue that large systems, nations, empires, even massive corporations often project their own structural flaws onto their enemies. They call it moral insulation.
So if a nation is secretly very aggressive, militaristic, and expansionist,
it'll obsessively accuse its enemy of being aggressive, militaristic, and expansionist.
It's the pot calling the kettle black, but on a literal nuclear scale.
Yes, but psychologically, think about what that projection does for the society. It stabilizes the system. Because if I can point to the terrifying monster over there across the ocean, I don't have to look at the structural violence I am committing right here at home. I don't have to look at my own crumbling infrastructure, my own poverty rates, my own corruption, or my own pollution.
Because I'm too busy fighting the bad guy. We all have to band together.
Exactly. The enemy becomes a necessary psychological prop to maintain our own fragile self-image. We actually need the enemy to avoid facing our own shadow.
So DMA is just a trap. It leads to endless war because you never actually solve the root tensions. You just try to destroy the people pointing them out. So what is the alternative? If we delete the DMA script from our collective hard drive, what do we replace it with?
The paper proposes a script called HDT, Holism, Dialectics, and Transcendence.
Which, I have to say, sounds a lot more like a couple's therapy session than a military strategy.
And that is exactly the challenge. It is much harder to do. Holism means seeing the world as one interacting system.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't separate from our enemies or from nature. We are part of the exact same web. What hurts the web hurts us.
You can't drill a hole in the other end of the boat and expect to stay dry.
Perfect analogy, yes.
Okay, what about dialectics?
This is the philosophical idea that contradictions are completely natural. Tensions aren't wars to be won. They are engines of change. It is not good versus evil. It is simply different forces pushing against each other, trying to find balance.
And then transcendence.
This is the ultimate goal. Instead of winning by destroying the other side, you solve the problem by moving to a higher level of integration. You redesign the system, so the conflict is literally no longer necessary.
The paper uses a marriage analogy here, which I thought was just great.
It's perfect for this.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine a married couple arguing over chores. The DMA script would be, I am right, you are lazy and evil, and I must win this argument and crush your will until you submit.
That ends in divorce.
Yeah.
Or a very, very miserable marriage.
Right. But the HDT script would be, we have a mismatch in our needs right now. We are a holistic unit, a family. So how do we transcend this specific argument and redesign our household routine so that both of our needs are met?
You don't defeat your spouse. You solve the problem together.
Exactly. But here is the kicker, and the authors are very honest about this. HDT requires cognitive complexity.
Huh.
It takes patience. It takes empathy. DMA is fast. It fits on a bumper sticker. Crush the enemy.
Yeah, HDT takes a whiteboard and like 3 hours of difficult conversation.
But the expert analysis in the paper points out that while DMA is easier in the short term, it is literally suicidal in the long term. Because in a globally interconnected world, especially one with nuclear weapons and a single shared climate, you literally cannot destroy the other side without destroying yourself.
We are tethered together. DMA ignores the tether. HDT respects it.
Precisely.
Okay, so we have got the architecture, the triangle, and the software, the script. Now we need to look at the engine. What is actually driving this whole machine? Why are we so stuck in this destructive DMA loop? And the paper pivots here to what they call the ruling value code.
This is the economic engine. And the authors draw very heavily here on the work of the philosopher John McMurtry. They lay out a literal equation that dictates our global behavior.
I have it right here. And I want to read this slowly for you listening because it is so stark when you see it laid out like this.
Rationality equals self-maximizing choice.
Self-maximization equals more money to the self.
System growth equals moral good.
Everything else, life, nature, society, equals disposable means.
That right there is the hidden source code of the global economy. Rationality itself has been completely redefined. We are taught from birth that to be rational is to look out for number one. And in a capitalist system, looking out for number one mathematically means accumulating capital.
So if I burn down 1,000 acres of ancient rainforest to plant soy to sell for a massive profit, I am being rational according to this code.
Not just rational.
Yeah.
You are being productive. You are a job creator. You are contributing to growth. The system rewards you. The stock market goes up. GDP goes up. The entire system cheers for you.
Even though I just destroyed a lung of the planet. Even though I have violently displaced indigenous communities.
Because in this governing equation, the rainforest and those communities are just disposable means. Their only value to the system is what they can be sold for. They have zero intrinsic right to exist outside of the market.
And this leads to what I think is the most provocative analogy in the whole paper, the cancer analogy. Now, usually when people compare capitalism to cancer, they're just being poetic or they're shouting into a megaphone at a protest. But the authors here, remember, one of them is a practicing medical doctor. They insist this is a strict structural and biological diagnosis.
They are very, very specific about this comparison. Let's look at the actual pathology of a carcinoma, what literally defines a cancer cell. First, it disconnects from the regulatory commands of the host body. It stops listening to the chemical signals that say, stop growing, we have enough tissue here.
Right.
Second, its only goal becomes to make more of itself. Endless replication. Growth. For the sake of growth.
Self-maximization.
Exactly. And third, it actively appropriates resources, blood, nutrients, oxygen from the healthy parts of the body to feed its own endless expansion. It grows numerically, but it degrades the host.
It starves a healthy tissue just to feed the tumor.
And here is the fatal, inescapable logic. If the cancer succeeds, if it grows without limit, the host dies. And when the host dies, the cancer dies.
It's a suicide pact.
It is a fundamentally suicidal logic of unconnected growth. The paper argues that our ruling value code money making money without any reference to the physical life support systems of the planet is structurally identical to a carcinoma.
That is, man, it's terrifying because it completely reframes the word growth. We are trained every day to think growth is always good. The economy grew by 3%. Hooray!
But in biology, growth is only good up to a very specific point. Your liver grows until it is the right size for your body, and then it stops. It maintains. Only a disease grows forever. When we celebrate a GDP rise that was caused by activities that poison the water table or destabilize the climate, we are literally cheering for the tumor to get bigger.
And this engine, this cancer-like imperative for endless growth, it hooks up directly with the DMA script and the violence. The paper calls this the war state connection.
Right. Because if your goal is infinite growth on a physically finite planet, eventually, you run into hard limits. You need more oil. You need more lithium for batteries. You need cheaper labor. You need entirely new markets to sell your excess goods.
And what happens if those resources are in someone else's land? Or if those people don't want to be a market for your stuff?
Then you need force. You need the war state. The military essentially becomes the global enforcement arm of the economic code. It secures the shipping lanes. It protects the overseas investments. It forces open the closed markets.
The paper makes this really sharp point that security in this context just becomes a mask.
Yes. It creates a situation where public funds, your tax dollars, my tax dollars, are poured into the military to protect private risks and private profits. It is a massive, invisible public subsidy for corporate expansion.
So we, the taxpayers, pay for the multi-billion-dollar aircraft carrier that protects the oil tanker, that brings the record profits directly to the oil company's shareholders.
Exactly. The public takes the financial risk of the war. The public takes the physical risk of the war. The public takes the environmental damage. But the profit remains entirely private. And how is this justified to the public? Do the politicians stand at the podium and say, we are sending your kids to war to secure quarterly shareholder value?
Obviously not. They use the DMA script. They say, we are fighting tyranny. We are defending freedom. So
the culture, the DMA script hides the structure, the economic code. It all connects. It is a completely seamless web.
But here's the thing that drives me crazy as I read this. We have massive crises constantly now. We had the 2008 financial crash. We have unprecedented climate disasters every single year. We have global pandemics. You would think that eventually the system would just break under the pressure of reality. You'd think a massive crisis would force everyone to stop and say, hey, this grammar is wrong. We need to change the code. But the paper says the exact opposite happens.
Yes. And this is segment 4, the self-sealing feedback loop. This perfectly explains why the system feels so impossible to change.
Self-sealing.
The system essentially has an immune response to its own failures. The totally counterintuitive fact is that crises, whether it's a war, a crash, or a climate disaster, they do not destabilize this system. They actually reinforce it.
Walk us through that cycle. The paper uses a resource riot as an example, right? Let's break that down.
Okay. Step one, the structural code maximize profit leads to extraction. Let's say a multinational company drains a local water table to bottle and sell soda. Now, the locals have no drinking water.
Right.
Step two, this structural violence creates a visible crisis. The locals riot. They attack the bottling factory. That is direct violence. Now, step three, how did the system interpret that crisis? Does the government say, oh, our economic code is fundamentally flawed because it incentivized taking their water?
No way. It immediately switches to the DMA script.
Exactly. It frames the riot entirely as a security threat. The locals are suddenly labeled as thugs, terrorists, or anti-business radicals.
The solution offered by the system is more of the ruling code. We need more armed security guards. We need the riot police. We need to restore law and order.
So the response to the damage caused by the system is to double down on the force protecting the system.
Precisely. The system gets stronger, the police budget goes up, the surveillance state expands, and the root cause, the lack of water, remains completely untouched. In fact, it gets worse because now the community is being heavily policed and they are still thirsty.
It's the exact same dynamic with the war on terror, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Structural violence and war cause blowback. They cause resentment, radicalization, and eventually terrorism. Then the terrorism is framed using DMA. Evil is attacking us because they hate our freedom. The solution offered is more war, which inevitably causes more blowback. It is a perpetual motion machine of violence.
And the paper talks about this overarching narrative of inevitability, this cultural idea that we literally cannot imagine anything else.
That is the ultimate gaslighting of the public. We hear phrases all the time like, there's no alternative, or, well, that's just how the market works.
Yeah, you can't fight the market.
Right. As if the market were gravity, as if it were a fundamental law of physics like thermodynamics. This narrative prevents us from even thinking about a different grammar. It normalizes the completely unimaginable. We just accept the slow destruction of the biosphere as a cost of doing business. We accept mass homelessness as a natural side effect of urban development.
So if I'm tracking this, we are trapped in a self-sealing, cancer-like, warmongering loop that constantly gaslights us into thinking it's the only possible way to live. I'm not going to lie, this is usually the part of the deep dive where I just want to curl up into a ball.
I know. It is a very grim diagnosis. But remember, a diagnosis is the absolutely necessary first step to a cure. If you know you have a tumor, you can treat it. If you think it's just a chronic stomach ache, you die.
The grammar approach is actually incredibly hopeful because if you understand that this is all just a coded software, it's not hardware, then you realize you can rewrite it.
Which brings us to segment five, the viability architecture. Moving from the diagnosis to the solution, the paper calls for what they term a constructive reframing. And notice the primary goal here, structural accountability without demonization.
Right, because if we just demonize the bankers or the corrupt politicians, we're just slipping right back into the DMA script,
yeah.
Us versus them.
Exactly. If you just swap out the people at the top, if you drag all the billionaires to the guillotine, but you keep the exact same grammar running in the background, the new leaders will eventually do the exact same things. The equation of rationality equals money will inevitably corrupt them too. We have to swap the grammar itself.
So what does the new grammar actually look like? What is the viability principle?
It proposes a fundamentally new definition of rationality. Listen to this closely. A system is rational if and only if it preserves and regenerates the life support conditions that enable its continuation.
Wow, that sounds, remarkably sensible.
It is a total inversion of our current reality. Instead of life serving growth, growth must serve life. If an economic activity destroys the water table, it is structurally irrational, no matter how much quarterly profit it generates. In a viability context, that profit is literally just a bookkeeping error because it failed to account for the destruction of the underlying asset.
It seems so obvious when you say it out loud, yet it changes literally everything about how the world works.
It changes everything. And the paper doesn't just leave it at philosophy. It outlines four core design shifts to make this real. It's mechanics.
Let's go through them. Shift one, ecological accounting.
Right now, the price of a cheap fast food hamburger does not include the costs of the cleared rainforest, the massive water usage, or the methane emissions. Those are called externalities.
Right.
The public pays for those, or future generations pay for them. The shift means prices must finally tell the ecological truth.
So cheap goods that destroy the planet wouldn't actually be cheap anymore.
Correct. The market signal would finally align with physical reality. If you damage the life support system to make a product, the cost goes way up. If your process regenerates the environment, the cost goes down.
Shift 2. Public monetary sovereignty. Now, this one is a bit technical, but bear with us.
It basically means money itself should be a public utility designed to facilitate life support, like building hospitals, schools, green energy infrastructure, rather than a tool for private speculation. Right now, most money is actually created by private banks as debt to fuel asset bubbles. The paper argues money should serve the public good, not the other way around.
Okay, shift 3, demilitarized security. Now, does this mean just abolishing the army tomorrow and hoping for the best?
No, not at all. It means fundamentally reframing what the word security actually means. Right now, security means the ability to destroy an enemy. In a viability architecture, security means resilience. Think about it. Do we have a stable climate? Do we have a robust, localized food system that can survive a multi-year drought? Do we have a healthcare system with enough surge capacity to handle a global pandemic without collapsing? That is true security.
Right.
You can't shoot a hurricane. You can't bomb a novel virus. Building more nuclear submarines does not make you secure against the actual physical threats of the 21st century.
So it's shifting the massive national budget from threat elimination to life preservation.
Precisely. It is moving from DMA security to HDT security.
And the final shift, feedback transparency.
We need to see the full systemic life cycle cost of all our collective decisions. We need to clearly see the life costs. If a new trade policy raises GDP by 2%, but statistically increases childhood cancer rates by 10% in manufacturing zones, we need to see that clearly linked on the national dashboard.
It's almost like giving the global system a central nervous system that actually feels pain when it does damage to its own body.
That is a brilliant way to put it. Right now, the system is totally numb to life damage. It only feels money damage. We need to reconnect the nerves.
But the paper talks about transition mechanisms, right?
Right.
Because how do we actually get there? Yeah. We can't just flip a giant switch and reboot global civilization overnight.
They suggest highly pragmatic steps, like dual accounting. Start by legally requiring nations and corporations to track standard GDP and a standardized life support index side by side. Let the public see the divergence. Let them clearly see that while the economy is technically growing, our actual life support capacity is rapidly shrinking.
And incentivize regenerative industries. Make it massively profitable to fix the environment rather than destroy it.
Yes. And culturally, and this is something everyone can do right now, we have to change our language.
Language. That brings us right back to the grammar.
We have to actively stop using their words. Stop saying collateral damage. Say civilian harm. Stop saying externalities. Say life costs. Stop saying standard of living when what you really mean is level of consumption.
Life costs. That really sticks with you.
Once you change the language you use every day, you begin to break the spell of the cultural violence. You make the invisible visible. Once you can clearly see the grammar, you can finally rewrite it.
Well, this has been an incredibly heavy deep dive, but I have to say I feel strangely clarified.
That is exactly the goal of the paper. The authors explicitly state their mission isn't to make you feel guilty or depressed. It's to give you structural clarity.
We started today by talking about that overwhelming feeling of everything everywhere all at once. The chaos. The late night doom scrolling anxiety.
And we've moved to seeing that it's not actually random chaos at all. It is a design. It's a violence architecture driven by a highly specific code of self-maximizing growth and a predictable script of binary conflict.
It's the cancer analogy. We are living inside a system that is literally programmed to eat its own home.
But we are also the programmers. That is the crucial hopeful takeaway. This isn't a law of nature. It is just a code we wrote. We can rewrite it.
I really love the final thought from the source material. The task is not to identify villains, but to reprogram incentives.
It completely changes the question you ask yourself. When you see a war or a market crash or a massive environmental scandal, don't ask, who's the bad guy here? Ask, what systemic logic are we participating in? Is this the cancer code at work?
Like they say, once you see the grammar, you just can't unsee it.
You really can't. I guarantee you'll watch the news tonight and you will spot the DMA script being used in the first 30 seconds. You'll clearly see the growth code hiding behind the environmental report.
And that is the first step. You have to be able to see the matrix before you can leave it.
Exactly.
So to you listening, next time you see a headline that just makes your blood boil, take a breath. Ask yourself, is this DMA at work? Is this the growth code functioning exactly as it was designed to? And what would the viability version of this exact same story look like?
That is the most important question we can possibly ask right now.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. We'll see you next time.
Take care.